It's Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2009 podcast series. Today we're speaking with Dr. Gerald Corey to discuss existential therapy. Dr. Gerald Corey is a professor emeritus of human services at California State University at Fullerton, a licensed psychologist, a national certified counselor, a fellow of the American Counseling Association, and a fellow of the Association for Specialists in Group Work. He is the author or co-author of many counseling textbooks and numerous journal articles. Dr. Corey earned his doctorate in counseling from the University of Southern California. Welcome, Dr. Corey, and thank you for joining us today to discuss existential therapy.
Good. Hi.
Hi.
Glad to be here.
Yes. Okay. The first question I have is, what is existential therapy?
Existential therapy is really not a model of therapy or even a theory of therapy. It's much more a way of thinking about psychotherapy and the therapeutic endeavor. Mm-hmm. So it has a lot more to do about how a therapist thinks about what his or her role is as a counselor, as well as what is the primary purpose of therapy.
How are the existential themes of freedom, responsibility, and anxiety, for example, relevant for the therapeutic practice?
Well, I think that the notion of freedom and responsibility is really running through most counseling sessions, if a counselor were really to listen for them. And I think a lot of clients come in because they're wrestling and struggling with the notions that they do have freedom. And when they realize that they're free and they can make choices, I think they also have anxiety about, well, what are the consequences of these choices and where are these choices leading me? So I think, regardless of what a particular problem a client might bring in, I think underneath that often is a theme, or if you want to call it that, a struggle between how am I handling freedom and responsibility in my life, which also leads to anxiety.
Is the anxiety because, for example, if somebody comes in and I'm talking to them as the counselor, and I notice that they are feeling victimized by any number of circumstances, and they're not feeling free. So is part of them feeling they are free or having choice, is part of that getting rid of the victim piece?
Well, I think that this approach looks at people in terms of maybe survivors more than victims. And I don't think an existential therapist would lecture a person and say, now there, you're not a victim. But I do think that there are many circumstances that happen to us, and that we're not just freely choosing certain plights that happen to us. I think there are a lot of tragedies and crises that occur, and I'm not saying that an existential therapist says, okay, the person is responsible for everything that goes on in his life. But I think the notion of anxiety really hinges upon the uncertainty of life. I think there are no guarantees. We just don't know existentially what we'll be encountering, what will be happening to our loved ones, what our future is. And I think that is a concern that a lot of clients bring in to their psychotherapy sessions, an underlying anxiety.
As a young student at UCLA, I read Viktor Frankl for the first time. And I read some portion of Frankl where he talked about how he was in the concentration camp, he was looking out the window, and he thought he had nothing. He had nothing left, and he said to himself, that's not true. I still have a choice about how to think about this. That was just stunning to me. And is Frankl considered, even though he's not exactly a psychologist, is that correct?
He's a psychiatrist.
He's a psychiatrist, okay.
And I think Frankl was a founder of the existential approach, and his brand is called Logotherapy, and a classic book that he wrote that I used for my high school students many, many years ago was called Man's Search for Meaning.
Yes.
And I think, to expand on this notion you just mentioned, Frankl said, certainly we don't choose certain things that happen to us, like being in a death camp that he was. He says, but ultimately, the one freedom that they couldn't take away from him was his freedom to choose his attitude toward his plight. And I think that may make the whole difference. You just said a few minutes ago something about being a victim.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as soon as people realize that things have happened to them, in some cases horrible things, that maybe they're no longer victim. Maybe they can begin to become survivors and see that they have some options. So I think Frankl was saying that we always have some element of choice, not very much, but at least some element of choice, like how we'll relate to a crisis that happens in our life, or when difficult circumstances are facing us.
He, it was very meaningful to me that he said, I can choose the way I think about this. I can choose my attitude. I mean, in a concentration camp, oh, my God, you know, how I can't think of much worse than seeing people die around you and all of that, you know. And I think I also, as an undergraduate studying existentialism, I remember thinking that it's a dark study, but it's really not when you think about Frankl. And his, you know, his view of it, it's not as dark as one thinks.
No, I think, well, one thing that attracts me to the existential approach is I think there is a great deal of optimism in this approach. Talking about Frankl, his whole theme was that we're searching for meaning and purpose in our life. And that's not something that we settle upon once and for all and say, aha, I found meaning in my life. I've got it now. I think it's something that we need to re-examine, and at different phases in our life, we're challenged to find perhaps new meaning. So I think really that's a major factor in bringing clients into counseling. At times, they've lost a sense of purpose or direction in their life. So I think this is very optimistic that this approach says you can create meaning and a new existence. You're not stuck with an old identity.
In what ways is the search for meaning a contemporary challenge?
Well, I think that
I mean, why today is it more of a challenge?
Well, maybe because there's so much emphasis on getting ahead, making it in the world as defined by material successes. And I think that frequently people have accumulated a lot of goods and things, and yet they may still say, somehow the meaning of my life has eluded me, or this isn't bringing me satisfaction. And I think what Frankl and others are saying, like Alfred Adler, he talked a lot about what we're built to do is find goals and meaning in life, and we're future-oriented. And Adler, who was a forerunner of the existential approach, basically said that, you know, we're meant to go outside of ourselves and give to others. His whole notion of social interest, I think, has a lot to do with finding meaning, that we don't find meaning encapsulated in our own being and our own self-pursuits, but maybe we need to go outside of ourselves and be concerned about bettering the world, bettering society, and finding some way of connecting with others and making a difference in the world.
Yeah, you know, one thing I find very interesting right now is the baby boomers are getting close to retirement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 58, and as I look around to some of my friends who are maybe 5 years older or so, and they're thinking about retirement, and one thing that struck me recently was this couple whom I have been friends with for many years. They sold their business and they retired, and it seems like it was just going to be perfect. You know, they were going to have money and time to do what they wanted to do. And I was very surprised to arrive at their house in San Francisco once after traveling back from Virginia, where I live now. And they were saying, we're not as happy as we thought we were going to be. We thought we were going to be very happy with just having nothing to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, isn't this about the lack of meaning?
Well, I think, you know, existential therapy, I think, is mm-hmm. particularly appropriate for people who are going through some kind of developmental crisis mm-hmm. or change in their life, or who are at a crossroads in their lives. And retirement is one of those.
Mm.
And for some people, they find a great deal of satisfaction in non-work activities. Maybe they're doing things with others or hobbies that they're pursuing. I think for many people, they go through a certain kind of crisis of, now what am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even an emptiness, particularly mm-hmm. if work filled the void
mm.
and if work was the primary source of their existence.
Mm-hmm.
I know, speaking personally, I'm 72
mm-hmm.
and I haven't retired.
Thank goodness.
Work as much as I ever have. And to me, I don't look forward to pulling back or
mm-hmm.
retirement.
Mm-hmm.
I get a great deal of meaning from doing something that you and I are doing now, or
mm-hmm.
writing, or teaching courses, which I still do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the existential approach challenges us at a time like, let's say, retirement,
mm-hmm.
to say, now how do you want to redesign your life?
Mm.
And it doesn't have to be a massive redesigning. It may be just a tweaking
mm-hmm.
Or maybe subtle changes in some ways. But I think, again, that our existence isn't settled once and for all.
Mm.
And for many people, I think retirement is the time when they can say, well, now I can branch out and do some things that I've always wanted to do.
Mm.
So again, I think existential therapy would help a person kind of see what are the possibilities, which are maybe limitless.
Yes, that really makes sense to me. And then also, how are the existential notions of death and meaning in life related? Because I always think one of the things about people who are moving into retirement or that period where one traditionally retires is that death is kind of hanging around in the background, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So how are the existential notions of death and meaning in life related?
Well, you know, there's a psychiatrist, Irvin Yalom.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Oh, yes. And he is kind of a pioneer
uh-huh.
in existential psychotherapy in the United States. And
uh-huh.
his classic book is Existential Psychotherapy,
uh-huh.
1980.
Uh-huh.
And he talks about the givens of existence. And one of them
what
is,
does that mean, the givens?
Oh, he talks about ultimate existential mm-hmm. concerns that all humans must face. That
mm.
by being human we struggle with. For
mm-hmm.
example, one is death, that ultimately we come to terms with our mortality
mm-hmm.
that we don't have forever, and
mm-hmm.
that at some point in time we'll not be in this world anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talks about existential isolation.
Hmm.
He talks about anxiety and meaninglessness in life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think death is one of those givens or
mm-hmm.
basic human themes that many of us think, well, particularly when we're very young, I have forever to go on. And
yes.
then we see other young people dying, sometimes
mm-hmm.
a tragic death,
mm-hmm.
and then we begin to realize, well, I don't have forever. I'm
mm-hmm.
finite.
Mm-hmm.
And that life on this planet mm-hmm. is really very brief, mm-hmm. relatively speaking. And I think that can almost jar us, shake us up, can be a catalyst to say, okay, if I have X amount of time, am I liking the way I'm living?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, what can I do about changing what I'm doing so that I find more meaning in my life?
Mm-hmm.
Or even if I like what I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
how can I continue and expand upon that?
Yes.
So I think death and meaning are like two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one great book that Yalom wrote, a new one of his, is called Staring at the Sun.
Hmm.
Staring at the Sun. And his basic theme in that is that we only can stare so long at the sun,
mm-hmm.
And then we have to turn away from it. And he says, same so with death, death awareness.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, and mm-hmm. he's thinking that many clients bring into therapy, even
mm-hmm.
though they don't talk about it directly,
mm-hmm.
death awareness and existential anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the notion that we have limited time
mm-hmm.
can focus us, you know, on what do I want to do with the time that I do have.
Mm.
And it can encourage us to reflect
mm-hmm.
on the quality of our lives and also the lives of others in our lives and our relationships. So
mm-hmm.
death and meaning, I think, are really so bound up. And it doesn't have to be a terribly pessimistic type of thing where we're constantly
mm-hmm.
thinking, oh, I have this much less time.
Right.
But I think we all realize, at least I frequently say, I can't believe how quickly a year has gone by.
Mm.
You know, and I think many people
mm-hmm.
are saying this, that they realize that, you know, time is speeding by.
Mm.
It causes them to think, well, what am I doing
mm-hmm.
with the time that I have?
One of the hats I wear here at American Counseling Association is Director of Career Services. And an interesting call I've gotten a number of times, and I got it just again last week, was somebody calling and saying, well, you know, I'm 45, and I want to make a career change. And I know it's kind of late, but I'm actually thinking of becoming a counselor.
Mm-hmm.
And what would I have to do? And I always say to these people who call who are making a midlife change like that, I say, this is a profession that is wonderfully suitable to age in, you know? It's not, I remember reading Memories, Dreams, and Reflections by
mm-hmm.
Jung many years ago, and he was saying it's a great profession to grow old in, you know, because you can sit and talk with people, and it's one of the things where, you know, people don't really want to go to a 25-year-old counselor.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're 75, if you're 80, if you're 85, you know, like Jung and many of his contemporaries went on to have a practice late in life, it works out just fine in this profession.
Mm-hmm.
So these people who are 45 and wanting to make a change, I say, go ahead. It sounds pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One of the things when you were talking about death and meaning in life, this is, you know, I think this is related, but let me know, is I remember reading Mother Teresa would often say that there was value in suffering.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about that?
Okay, let me comment on that. You know,
yeah.
I want to reflect on the comment that you made, your remarks about careers, too.
Yes.
Just a little afterthought with that.
Sure.
I recently collected some personal stories
mm-hmm.
from students in master's and doctoral program for a book that I was working on
mm-hmm.
About who's mentored them and
mm.
how they've you know, chosen counseling as a career.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of them were people in their 40s and some even 50s
mm-hmm.
who came back for a master's or a doctoral program,
mm-hmm.
and they were successful in business, for example, several.
Yes.
But they said, you know, I want to do something more with my life. So,
mm-hmm.
and I think this is a perfect example
mm-hmm.
of existential challenge, that
mm-hmm.
the person was satisfied. They weren't bemoaning their fate and mm-hmm. saying, I hate what I'm doing,
mm-hmm.
but they somehow felt that there was more that they
yes.
wanted. They wanted to give more to people, and
yes.
not just in the business sense. And so I think that, you know, that element of changing and our careers change.
Uh-huh.
We may start as teachers and then become counselors and then become
right.
authors. And, you know,
right.
It just seems that that's the beauty of existential approach, that there's so many opportunities and
you know,
challenges.
One of the things you just said reminded me that woman who called last week said, I realize I've spent most of my life keeping a product on a shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I want to become a counselor, but I'm almost scared to say it because I'm so old. I'm 45. And first of all, I'm not so old, but okay.
Right.
But, you know, when she said, you know, I've spent my life keeping a product on a shelf,
mm-hmm.
that really struck me.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, maybe there's something to be old, being older
mm-hmm.
and thinking of the counseling profession. So I think, again, mm-hmm. existential would say, where is it written that you have to, you know, stop your productivity after a certain age?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned about suffering.
Yes. This was in something I read by Mother Teresa, and she said there is value in suffering. And I thought, what does she mean by that? What do you think she meant by that?
Well, you know, I think that's part of living.
Mm.
It's not a part that I think many of us, including myself, are drawn to necessarily, but
mm-hmm.
I think there are a lot of aspects in life where we suffer. And I think that we can learn something about ourselves and about our way of being in the world, about how we relate to suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this approach is particularly helpful for people who are suffering or who are crisis situations
mm-hmm.
when there's a devastating hurricane or
mm-hmm.
earthquake or a mass shooting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there are answers.
Mm.
And sometimes things don't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
But I think people who are going through a period of suffering need somebody to listen to them
yes.
and understand them and not reassure them that now I'm sure everything's going to work out fine. things will be better
mm-hmm.
after 6 months. I think they need to be able to go through their suffering with
mm-hmm.
them
mm-hmm.
and allow people to talk about their pain
mm-hmm.
and not try to fix them.
Right, right.
You know,
it's kind of, doesn't suffering too, sometimes it just takes us to a deeper place in
right.
the world.
Exactly.
Like we thought maybe, you know, the world was only so deep, and then you,
right.
Through suffering, I know, through, you know, I had never had the death of a really close person, and then my father died. And
mm-hmm.
I remember thinking, wow, Rebecca, this sadness is not going away like it always did in the past. What
right.
happened? There's a whole new thing going on here.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah.
Right. And so I don't think, well, death is a good example in losing
mm-hmm.
people in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes my mother was 94, 96
mm-hmm.
when she died. I can't remember which. I think 94.
Wow, and what a nice long life.
Yeah, and she lived pretty rich life to the end. She
mm-hmm.
enjoyed her life, but it's always hard to see a person that we love leave
mm-hmm.
us. And I was recently at a conference, and a person was talking about a postmodern approach to mourning. And he said, so often in the Western approach,
mm-hmm.
we're taught, get over it and go through the mourning and forget the person after all they're gone,
mm-hmm.
You know, get on with your life. And
mm-hmm.
he's saying, why is that necessary? And his whole idea was maybe we can
mm-hmm.
keep people in our thoughts, in our lives, and in the community,
mm-hmm.
even though they're no longer physically with
mm-hmm.
us, that we can still have memories of them, we can still talk about them,
mm-hmm.
we can still share stories about their lives, we can
mm-hmm.
still remember what they taught us, we can
mm-hmm.
still see pictures of them, videos.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had a very different approach To,
I like that.
Yeah, I do too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different approach.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the counselor who tries to fix a person wouldn't allow for the person. They would try to say, well, you'll get over it. And so suffering maybe can teach us, I think you said it, a way to deepen our existence.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Viktor Frankl said, there are different ways to find meaning in life.
Mm-hmm.
One is through work, another is through love,
mm-hmm.
and another is through suffering. I remember those three.
Oh, interesting.
And he may have said other, but
mm-hmm.
suffering was another path
mm-hmm.
towards finding meaning in life. And,
you know what's interesting? When you were saying that, I just flashed on. I lived in Korea for part of my professional life, and
mm-hmm.
We lived in a Korean neighborhood, my two little children, my husband and myself. And one day I was walking with my daughter down this little street, and they were bringing an old woman out in a stretcher who had died.
Mm-hmm.
And her daughter was holding on to her and just kind of screaming out in grief. And my daughter and I just stood there with our mouth open for a minute because we just didn't, you know, you just don't see this in America. And it was interesting that it was so, you know, it seemed so understood there
mm-hmm.
that somebody would be, you know, screaming and crying in this way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in America, we often do feel that we need to move on. This was a sad thing. It happened. Now let's move on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, right. You know, there's something about that deepening that we're talking about that is very important,
mm-hmm.
that I think leads to a richer life.
Right. Yeah.
Another question I have for you is bringing this back to our clinicians who are listening. How can a practitioner use the existential approach as a foundation and then integrate some other therapeutic approaches, for example, cognitive or behavioral approaches?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that this approach,
mm-hmm.
At least for me, serves as my foundational approach. But I think it's more of a philosophy of counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said in the beginning, a way of thinking about counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the essence of this, and I didn't say this in the beginning, is that really the counselor's job, my job as a therapist, would be
mm-hmm.
to really deeply understand the person that's sitting before me.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I'm doing a group, to be fully present
mm-hmm.
for the group.
Mm-hmm.
So this approach asks the question, what can I as a therapist do as a person
mm-hmm.
to show up, to be fully present and engaged?
Mm-hmm.
And so this approach is not one where there's one of professional distance, for
mm-hmm.
example.
Mm-hmm.
And this approach also challenges the therapist to be open to changing. I don't think our being can be unchanged if we really listen to our client's suffering and pain and struggles. It is bound to affect us.
If we're really there.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the core of this approach is the relationship
mm-hmm.
and the ability of the counselor to get inside the subjective world of the client and
mm-hmm.
see things through his or her eyes to
mm-hmm.
really understand the other through their own
mm-hmm.
perspective. So
mm-hmm.
with that in mind,
mm-hmm.
I think technique and strategies are always secondary. So
mm-hmm.
existential therapy would say understanding is primary, understanding the world of the client and the relationship,
mm-hmm.
the I-thou relationship is so
mm-hmm.
crucial. And secondarily, our techniques.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean we cannot use techniques,
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
you really can use, and this is what I love about this approach,
mm-hmm.
you can draw from Adlerian techniques,
mm-hmm.
you can draw from reality therapy, from strict behavior therapy,
mm-hmm.
from cognitive behavioral. I think there are a lot of ways of taking really all of the contemporary therapeutic approaches and taking some of those techniques and strategies and incorporating them within an existential way of thinking.
Hmm.
So one person I'm thinking, his name is Frank DiTilio.
Mm-hmm.
He's a well-known cognitive behavior therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a piece in 2002, and it was, he's a well-known cognitive behavior therapist, as I mentioned, but he said how he's existentially oriented, but he uses cognitive behavioral techniques to help a person work with, let's say, panic attacks,
mm-hmm.
or anxiety,
mm-hmm.
or depression. He goes deeper than just trying to cure the symptom.
Mm-hmm.
If a person has a panic attack or is anxiety-ridden, Dr. DiTilio would say, let's talk about what's going on in your life that's making you anxious. So I think we can always think more broadly and existentially,
mm-hmm.
about these ultimate concerns, like how is the client dealing with freedom, responsibility, anxiety,
mm-hmm.
Constant changing of meaning in life,
mm-hmm.
death awareness, all of these themes, I think.
Suffering.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of those, I
mm-hmm.
think, can also be related to, techniques from
yes.
other approaches, so long as we don't make the technique primary.
Yes. Yes. How does existential therapy have relevance for counseling from a multicultural perspective? I did a podcast recently with Dr. Cortland Lee and was, really fascinated with all of his thoughts on multiculturalism and diversity. And the follow-up to that question is, what are some of the strengths of this approach in terms of working with diverse client populations?
Well, you mentioned earlier about being in Korea.
Yes, yes.
And I'm thinking, because Mariana, my wife and colleague,
mm-hmm.
and I did some work in training, group training,
mm-hmm.
in Korea
mm-hmm.
just a few years back. And I think one of the things that called to my mind was the importance of not going into another culture with our own set of values and our
mm-hmm.
own framework and imposing it
mm-hmm.
on another culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that existential is a beautiful fit for working with diverse cultures, because
mm-hmm.
what we do when we go into another culture is we say, okay, maybe I can suspend some of my worldview
mm.
and not impose that
mm-hmm.
on a group of clients, but find out what are they struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, I think we found a lot of connections. I found when we've been to other countries
mm-hmm.
that there are these existential themes we talk about, like suffering,
mm-hmm.
pain.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen clients in other cultures have pain. Maybe it's over a different issue.
Mm-hmm.
And in Korea, it was frequently over an issue with women
mm-hmm.
not feeling valued
yes.
as their brothers were valued,
mm-hmm.
gender differences.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think an existential counselor wouldn't say, well, that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
They might say,
mm-hmm.
so talk about that, you
mm-hmm.
know, and they would try to understand from her perspective what
mm-hmm.
it's like to not be treated fairly
mm-hmm.
or not be treated the same as her brothers
mm-hmm.
or not be given an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think from an existential perspective, we're interested in understanding what is the client's world like from his or her vantage point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also worked in Japan, and one of the things we would talk about in the counseling agency in Japan was we would talk about how in Japan it was considered an aggressive act to look in somebody's eyes.
Right.
And in America, it's considered, you're not telling the truth or something
mm-hmm.
if you won't look in somebody's eyes.
Right.
So we had to really, I was part of this thing called the Kanto Plains Helping Professionals Coalition. It was American and Japanese counselors coming together and talking about the differences. You know, when we came together, we said, you know, we wanted to know, you know, what do you want to know about America? We have a few things we want to know about Japan. We want to try to understand better so we can do a better job here. We were counseling Army personnel and families, but many of these people had, of these Army individuals, had married cross-culturally. So we would, when we had somebody in for counseling, for example, and we had the wife and if she, or the husband who was Japanese, and they did not want to look at our eyes, you know, we had to really, really respect that because we don't want to be involved in an aggressive act, you know. So it was very interesting. And when you were talking about how the counseling relationship is more important than the technique, if you really wanted to have that counseling relationship in Korea or in Japan, the only other places I've actually lived, I visited a lot of countries, but lived in those two, you had to, you know, accept a number of things that were completely different from how you were taught when you got your master's in counseling.
Right.
You know, like looking at, and not confronting if you saw some cognitive dissonance, not confronting in the way you might do in America because it would be considered so angry.
Right. And I think there's a lot there about following the lead of the client. And you just talked about confronting. Like, I think an existential therapist, let's say, again, with a Korean client, let's say she's struggling with wanting a professional career, but her father's saying, I don't want you to go off and become a professional. I think you need to stay here and take care of your extended family. Now, I don't think an existential therapist would say, okay, you need to confront your father because you're free and you have a right to your own destiny. But I think what an existential therapist might say is, why are you in my office? And she might say, I'm really struggling because I want to honor and respect my father, and yet I also want, I'm very passionate about wanting something that my father doesn't value. And so I think my job as a therapist would be to help her explore and examine what are the consequences if she were to challenge her father, or what are the consequences if she were to chart her own course, you know, and say, I'm not going to pay attention to my father's wishes. So it's not my job to decide for her, even though some clients may desperately want us to.
And they ask us to sometimes.
Right. Oh, absolutely. In fact, I think this is a trend.
Yeah.
I think the trend is people desperately want advice and answers and to be fixed. As there are so many talk shows and radio shows and television shows, and the therapists on there are very quick to give answers. And this is just the opposite from an existential perspective. You know, so I don't think the existential counselor directs or tells or, you know, answers the person's predicament, but is with them to help them explore and to struggle and to ultimately make some choices. And I don't know if that, you know.
That's wonderful. That's, yeah, that makes consummate sense. Well, we're coming to the close of our conversation, but I have a question that I think, you know, is very important, and that is there anything I have not asked you that our members need to know about existential therapy? Is there, you know, is there something that comes to mind that I haven't asked in these questions that our listeners need to know, most of whom are clinicians?
Well, I have several on the top of my mind which I can add. And I'm sure once we finish this, I'll think of another.
We'll think of even
dozen.
More. Both of us will.
But one comes to mind
okay.
is what it takes to be an existential therapist. And I think, of course, to be any therapist, we have to know something about the theory and the approach and study it and be supervised, all of those elements.
Right, right.
But I think that may be very, very important to become an effective existential counselor. I think it means that we attend to our own being and our own lives.
Mm.
And maybe we can't be any better therapists than we are as human beings. And so if I'm living an inauthentic life, meaning I'm not choosing to become all whom I can become, or I'm letting others decide for me, and I'm not making any choices in my life, I think that it's going to be very hard for me to really be of any assistance to clients from an existential perspective. So I think that this approach really challenges us to look at how we're living, and are we living a full existence. And it's so important, I think, that we get our own personal therapy and do our own personal self-exploration, part of which might be not in the therapist's office, but maybe also, you know, in the context of going out to another culture and living in a different way, and it causing us to expand our vision. So I think the bottom line here is that as a counselor, existential counselor at least, that the best thing we have to offer our clients is who we are personally and our ability to make a connection with the client that's sitting in our office or in our group. So it's not just learning a technique, and it's not just being a skilled clinician, although that's important. But I think in this approach, it's how am I dealing with these existential themes? How am I dealing with anxiety in my life? How am I choosing to become the person that I could become?
Yeah, it seems to me if somebody is unable to be their authentic self, that it would be very difficult to be in that therapeutic relationship.
Where
you talk about the relationship being more important than the than the techniques, because you don't have the clarity if you're not being genuine. You know, there's like a cloud between you and the client. And it's very difficult to get over there if you aren't being genuine and working on yourself. And yeah, it doesn't have to be in therapy. There's many ways.
Right. Therapy is one avenue, but not the only. You know, and this is, there's so many other related therapies to existential therapy. Person-centered therapy with Carl Rogers as the founder, Gestalt therapy, psychodrama. They're really all those four therapies, psychodrama, gestalt therapy, person-centered therapy, and existential therapy, are really very closely related. And they all stress the importance of the I-thou relationship and the how important the therapeutic relationship is to outcome. As a matter of fact, one other point that I want to be sure to make is that the relationship, and I think research shows this, that regardless of the therapeutic orientation, the theory a therapist holds, what seems to be the most critical variable, the most critical variable, is the quality of the therapeutic relationship in terms of outcome. And so, you know, we talked, you mentioned earlier cognitive behavior therapy, which is very popular today, and there are a lot of very good elements to that. And yet, I think a cognitive behavior therapist would say it's extremely important that I create a therapeutic alliance and that the relationship, that the client is empowered to do his or her own work and that the client has the responsibility to do things beyond the therapeutic hour to make changes in his or her thinking and actions. And so that's very existential. You see, because a good cognitive behavior therapist says, I've got to work on the relationship. And if there's not a good quality relationship and a collegial partnership, then I don't think you're going to get good results, you see.
Another question that I neglected to ask you, but I want to ask you, and I hope we're not running over time now.
No, it's fine by me.
Okay, good. Is how well does existential therapy do in the group, in a group format?
Oh, well, I could talk another hour on that one.
Maybe we'll have to do that because I really, I'm thinking that it would lend itself well.
Absolutely. Mm. And as a matter of fact, I think that's how I came to appreciate, mm-hmm. The existential approach.
Mm-hmm.
For 25 years, we did week-long residential therapeutic groups from 1972 to 1997.
Mm-hmm.
Every summer, we did two of those groups.
Mm-hmm.
And existential themes came out in that.
Mm-hmm.
All of the themes we talk about in terms of redesigning our existence.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that the existential approach fits beautifully,
mm-hmm.
with a group format because all the members, mm-hmm. can be models to one another.
Mm-hmm.
And members who may have felt hopeless,
mm-hmm.
about their life and their future,
mm-hmm.
when they are with others who are struggling and maybe finding some light,
mm-hmm.
might be really inspired by, mm-hmm. others' journeys. So I think the group offers a very supportive and challenging environment. I'm thinking, mm-hmm. now of a group for bereavement,
yes.
or loss.
Mm-hmm.
What better format,
mm-hmm.
where eight people are talking about loss in their lives and how it's, mm-hmm. affecting them. They're not being cured, but they're allowed to share their stories,
mm-hmm.
and to work through and come to a deeper understanding,
mm-hmm.
of how loss can enrich their lives or how they can relate to this.
Yes.
So I think that, the existential approach is, mm-hmm. ideal for,
mm-hmm.
a group.
And I would think, even when you talk about a group for grief or loss, I would think that there would be some people in the group who might be sort of coming out of the other side of the intense grief and loss and the suffering that another member of the group was in the midst of.
Right.
And it would be so helpful to just see that person in all of their genuineness.
Absolutely.
And see them coming out the other side when you might be thinking at that moment that you can't come out the other side.
Right, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what existential counseling is all about is helping people expand their awareness,
mm-hmm.
and develop awareness.
Mm-hmm.
And when many people come into a group, for example, thinking, well, I am the way I am,
yes.
and there's not much more that I can do about changing.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they see other people and experience other people becoming more,
mm-hmm.
as a result of their choices, they might say, I never thought I could become a graduate student. I never thought,
yes.
I could become a counselor.
Yes.
I never thought I could become a mentor.
Right.
Yeah. So I think the group is a model that,
uh-huh.
one another can be very helpful in their sharing.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you so much, Dr. Gerald Corey, for joining me to discuss existential therapy. It was really a fascinating hour for me, and probably will be for our listeners. And let's do it again.
Okay.
Okay.
And one afterthought.
Yes, an afterthought. Yes.
Because we didn't even mention this.
Okay.
But I,
sure.
know this is always asked.
Okay.
The question about how does this approach fit with brief therapy,
yes.
and,
yes.
the demands that I have to see a lot of clients.
Yes.
I don't think that existential approach or person-centered approach,
mm-hmm.
is something that takes a great deal of time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we only have one opportunity,
mm-hmm.
to be with a person. And I think if we can really be deeply with them in one or six sessions, that can be life-changing and transformative.
Mm.
So,
especially if you're there in all of your genuineness and you're not, the cloud is not in between you.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so,
yeah.
I think that, at least a that could be discussed at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
A counselor could say, well, we're limited to 6 sessions, or our insurance won't pay any more than 8 sessions, or the center that I'm working for has this policy. Then it almost challenges a client to say, what are my priorities? What do I most want to talk about? What do I most want to change in my life? So I wanted to mention that at least because I think that sometimes people think, well, existential therapy takes a very, very long time. And of course, depends how deep we want to go. But I think that even with a short amount of time, we can challenge people to begin to kind of look within for more of their answers. And you know, this fits, and I'll wrap up with
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Well, this fits with reality therapy. You know, Bill Glasser years ago in the middle 60s talked about reality therapy, and his foundational approach was responsibility. He worked with, you know, a certain population that tried to blame others for their crimes and their deeds. And Glasser said, you know, you're not living a responsible sort of existence. Now, reality therapy has really transformed and evolved, and another pioneer in reality therapy is Robert Wobbelding, who is the director of reality therapy in Cincinnati. And he talks about, and it's very existential, he says he gets clients to look at what do you want, and then what are you doing in your life, and is what you're doing helping you get what you want in your ideal life? And then the core of reality therapy, at least from Wobbelding's perspective, is you make the evaluation of what you have in your life and what you might want differently. And then lastly, if you say, okay, I'm not satisfied with all these elements and here's what I'd like to be doing differently, then you plan for it. And Robert Wobbelding talks a whole lot about planning for change. And this is a hugely important piece in existential therapy. We don't just gather insights and get inspired. The existential counseling says if we want to change, we have to go out in the world and apply what we're learning in the office, so to speak, and make plans for change. In other words, action plans are critically important. So existential therapy isn't just kind of a luxury of coming to understand our and gain insights. It's really, okay, now that I've understood something about myself, what will I do with it? And so reality therapy is a good example, I think, of an existential approach that says, what changes do you want to make in your life and what can help you to make those changes?
And I love the idea of planning for change. I like that. And I also think that, you know, one of the themes of our conversation has been coming together with the authentic self. And when you come together with the authentic self, I would think it is possible to move forward a little more quickly if need be, given the situation you're in.
Right, absolutely.
You know, if it's only 6 sessions to...
Or whatever time we have.
Whatever time we have to, you know, to really come there with your authentic self and be genuine and move forward because there isn't that cloud in between you.
You know, and this is exactly what Carl Rogers talked about and was a revolutionary, and he wrote a, there's a whole book on him called The Life and Work of Carl Rogers that ACA put out.
I interviewed the author of that,
Howard Kirschenbaum.
That's right.
Yeah, and, you know, what Carl Rogers is basically teaching is what I need to do is show up and be fully present as I can for the client, be real, without pretenses, without professional facades. And Carl Rogers, what he taught basically was that the client is the expert, that the client has...
On themselves.
Right, and wisdom within themselves. And that the job of the therapist, he's very existential, is to release that growth capacity within the client. So I think Carl Rogers was really a prime example of an existential counselor who really said, we don't need diagnosis, we don't need testing, we don't need external understanding. What we need is the ability to be empathic and understand the world of our client. Mm-hmm. And, you know, quickly to wrap up, Rogers did so much towards the end of his life in going to other cultures.
Yes.
And listening to widely diverse points of view.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Rogers' passion was how can we get people with differing world views together so that they can listen and understand each other. And so Rogers was a clear pioneer in the existential approach, saying the most important tool the therapist has is your own being and your own presence and your own realness.
Your own genuineness, yes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when you talk about working with diverse clients and clients in different cultures, I don't think there's anything better that you can bring.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's so important. If you're going to learn about their culture and they're going to learn about yours, it's just being being genuine, being authentic, being who you are.
And I think I found that at least. I think people in other cultures are testing us or they're listening to see, does this person respect me? Does this person respect my values? And it's not our credentials or the books we've written. I think it's our ability to make a connection, and this is what existential therapy is all about, to make that link and that relationship with our clients.
Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for
joining
us today.
Well, it's been enjoyable.
Good, good. To view links to this program or to write to the host, go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the ACA 2009 podcast series, signing off.